Charlotte rescued the poor creature. Hero looked over at her friend. What kind of man hates dogs? Dogs don't like him. They growl and snap at him. The wisdom of animals, murmured Hero, as the princess turned to come running up to them, the dog at her heels.
Oh, I wish I could try skating, she said, laughing. Do you think Papa would permit it, Miss Kinsworth?
You could ask him, said Miss Kinsworth, in a voice that didn't hold out much hope for success. The princess pulled a face at her, then turned to Hero.
Do you skate, Lady Devlin?
I never have. Although if this weather keeps up, I fear we may all need to learn. Charlotte laughed again, then grew serious. The carefree child who'd been playing with her dog disappeared, her features schooled into a sober expression that gave a glimpse of the splendid queen she would one day be.
Miss Kinsworth says you wish to ask me about Jane Ambrose, about our lesson the day she died.
You're the last person known to have had any meaningful interaction with Jane that day. Can you remember anything about that morning, anything at all, that might shed some light on what happened to her?
Sorry, no. Believe me, I have gone over our conversation in my mind, but I can't think of anything.
Do you know where she planned to go after she left Warwick House?
I assumed she would be returning home, although I don't believe she ever actually said. We spoke of the cold, and she told me she'd heard the Cambridge stage was snowed up for 8 hours before they managed to pull it out, with most of the passengers nearly frozen to death. But I can't recall our discussing anything of a personal nature.
Did she seem worried or troubled to you?
The princess considered this a moment, then shook her head. I don't think I would say she was troubled, but there was something different about her. I can only describe it as a sort of fierceness of...
She broke off. Yes, Your Highness, prompted Hero.
It was as if she had finally made up her mind about something, and was both relieved and determined to carry through on her decision.
Charlotte gave a rueful smile.
I know it sounds an odd, fanciful thing to say, but I can't think of any other way to describe it. And it's no use asking me what she'd made up her mind about, because I've no notion at all.
It could mean nothing, Hero said to Devlin later, after she'd related the conversation to him. She was leaning against the doorway of his dressing room and watching him tie a rough black cravat around his neck. The cravat was black for the same reason his breeches were worn and his shirt frayed. Cat Boleyn had arranged for him to meet a smuggler named Archibald Potter at a tavern called the Cat and Fiddle, near Radcliffe Highway, and one did not venture into an area such as Whitechapel dressed like a Bond Street beau. Devlin met her gaze in the mirror. I wouldn't be too quick to dismiss Charlotte's observations. When you grow up at court surrounded by toadies, scheming courtiers, and a family as uniformly peculiar as the Hanovers, you learn to read people early. And well.
True, said Hero. But what does it mean?
She pushed away from the doorframe to go stand at the window overlooking the snow-filled street.
I feel as if we aren't getting anywhere. We just keep going round and round the same people and incidents, learning perhaps a bit more each time, and yet never really discovering what we need to know.
He glanced over at her, his eyes crinkling with a hint of a smile. That's because we're missing something. Something important.
But what?
He reached for a battered, low-crowned hat with a jaunty red feather in the band and settled it on his head. I don't know yet. She frowned.
How will you recognize this Archibald Potter?
I'll know him by his cocked hat and green-striped waistcoat, and he'll know me by this decidedly garish red feather, with our identities further confirmed by a prearranged conversation about my supposed recent travels to Jamaica.
Sounds decidedly insalubrious. You will be careful.
Devlin checked the knife he kept sheathed in his boot then slipped a small double-barrel flintlock into his pocket. "You keep saying that." She came to tug at the brim of his hat.
"And you never listen."
Chapter 29 The Cat and Fiddle was a smoke-fouled, ramshackle old half-timbered structure on John Street, not far from the vast warehouses of the East India Company. Sebastian selected a high-backed booth in a quiet corner, ordered a tankard of ale he had no intention of drinking, and settled in to wait. Archibald Potter, when he appeared, looked more like a comfortable middle-aged shopkeeper than a smuggler. Somewhere in his late 40s, he had full ruddy cheeks, bushy side whiskers, and a round, knobby nose. The combination could have made him look jovial and soft. It did not. His clothes were typical of an older generation, his waistcoat long and striped with green, his coat square-cut with broad lapels and large pockets. In place of a cravat, he wore a stock, and he had a cocked hat perched above a periwig. He stared at the red feather in Sebastian's hatband, then walked up to stand stiffly with his fingers tapping on the scarred tabletop. He was not smiling.
"I hear you're just back from Jamaica," he said, in guttural French, with a strong Kentish accent.
"The weather's much better than here," replied Sebastian in the same language.
"Huh. Where isn't it?"
With a grunt, the free trader slid into the opposite bench.
"Miss Cat says you want to know about smuggling in the Channel, with a particular emphasis on the activities of a certain Frankfurter we all know but few love. Says it's got something to do with a lady found with her head bashed in up in Clerkenwell."
"Yes." Potter stared at him long and hard.
"She swears I can trust you. You have my word."
The free trader turned to call for a tankard of ale before resting his shoulders against the bench's high back, his thick bushy brows drawing together in a frown.
"I've only ever known one other fella with yellow eyes, and he wasn't somebody I'd care to mess with. See well in the dark, do you?"
"Yes." Potter nodded.
"So did this fella. I met him in Dunkirk."
"I take it you spend a fair amount of time in France?"
"I was born there. For all that my parents were from Dover. Still got a sister in Gravelines. She takes care of the French end of the business while I deal with things over here."
"Convenient." Potter waited while a young barmaid slapped an overflowing tankard of ale on the table before him.
"That is that. Gravelines, you say?"
He took a deep swallow of his ale, then wiped the foam from his lips with the back of one hand.
"That's right. It ain't like the old days when we used to have to collect our contraband either in the Low Countries or off neutral ships in the Channel."
"So what's changed?"
"A few years ago, Napoleon got clever. He realized that if he worked with us smugglers, made it easy for us to do business with France, he could use us to get French goods into England, while at the same time keeping control over what we were bringing into France. So he issued this imperial decree, officially opening up a couple of French ports, first Wimereux and Dunkirk, then Gravelines, to smugglers. He even built special warehouses for us. Keeps them filled with lace, silk, leather, gloves, brandy, whatever we want."
"That was indeed clever. So what do you take to France? Besides the usual spies, of course." Archibald Potter grinned and leaned forward.
"Letters. English newspapers. Escape prisoners of war. And gold. Lots of gold. They even built a special quarter just for us in Gravelines. They call it the Ville des Smugglés."
"You're saying the entire operation is officially sanctioned by the French government?"
"It ain't just sanctioned. It's controlled. Organized. They got the ministers of police, finance, interior, war, and what have you. All writing reports and procedures and the like. You know the French. Ain't nobody like 'em for security passes, articles, rules, regulations. and any other kind of government paperwork a body would dream up.
They got something like 70 merchants and bankers in Gravelines, officially designated to deal with us.
Us being the smugglers, that's right. How many vessels are we talking about?
Hundreds.
Most of them are small, under 10 tons, with some of them smaller still. Smugglers like galleys, you see, especially for gold smuggling. They're light and easy to build, they don't need a lot of rowers, and they're fast. Plus, you can turn a galley and row it into the wind if you're unlucky enough to stumble upon the bloody water guard.
Sebastian ran one finger up and down the side of his tankard.
Tell me about Rothschild.
Archibald Potter hunched his shoulders and leaned in closer, dropping his voice lower.
They call 'em the family, you know. Ain't nobody more active in the Channel than them. Lots of other London merchants and bankers finance operations, but the Rothschilds, they run their own bloody ships, specially constructed with secret compartments. They don't just use kegs with false heads and hollowed-out pigs of iron hidden under the ballast. They got secret drawers built into the binnacles that open by springs, false ceilings, anything you can think of. And probably more than a bit you can't. And they're all flying flags with that Rothschild red shield and gold eagle.
So they don't get stopped, said Sebastian. The Rothschilds paid a number of officials in various countries to look the other way. And even those who weren't paid off were frequently too afraid to tangle with such a powerful, wealthy family.
They don't get stopped very often, that's for sure. And if they do get caught with contraband, all Nathan Rothschild needs do is claim he don't know anything about it. Just lays the blame for any illicit cargo they find on the crew and the captain. That way the ship's not forfeit, and it's the crew that gets hauled off into custody.
I wouldn't think they'd keep quiet.
They do, if they've any sense.
A revenue cutter stopped a Rothschild ship just a few weeks ago. The Viking, with a secret cargo of guineas in her stern. The revenuers took the captain and crew into custody. A few days later, they just... Potter flatted his hands through the air like a conjurer doing a trick.
Disappeared. Everyone knows Rothschild's got friends in high places. People who make sure anything he wants to happen, happens.
Sebastian felt a quickening of interest.
When did you say the Viking was stopped?
Potter shrugged.
First part of the month, during that nasty great fog we had.
According to Nathan Rothschild, Jane Ambrose's final lesson with little Anna Rothschild had taken place on a Tuesday at the end of the great fog. It could mean nothing, of course, but then again... He became aware of Archibald Potter studying him with renewed interest.
"You got Scottish in you?" asked the Free Trader suddenly.
Sebastian shrugged.
"Some. Why? You remember that fellow I was telling you about? The one with the yellow eyes?"
"Yes."
"He had a Scottish name, for all he was a French colonel."
Sebastian kept his hands steady by pressing them flat on the table.
"Oh?
What was his name?" he asked, his voice sounding convincingly casual.
"Mark something. Can't recall exactly. But he looked more than a bit like yourself, except older, of course. Old enough by now to maybe be your father, I reckon."
"Interesting," said Sebastian, his features carefully schooled into an expression of polite boredom, even as he felt the blood coursing through his veins hard enough that for one pulsing moment he heard a roaring in his ears. Leaving the Cat and Fiddle, Sebastian turned his steps toward the river, his gaze on the heavy white clouds pressing down on the city. But his thoughts were in the past. He was the third son and fourth child born to the marriage of the Earl of Hendon and his beautiful, restless wife, Sophia. He'd always known he was different from his brothers, Richard and Cecil. Different in looks, interests, talents, and temperament. And so very, very different from their father, the Earl. He'd grown up feeling like an outsider in his own family, wondering why his eyes were a strange feral yellow rather than the startling blue that was such a strong characteristic in the sincere family, and wondering at the anger and disappointment he often glimpsed in the Earl's face when he gazed upon his unsatisfactory third son. But somehow it had never occurred to Sebastian to wonder if he was really Hendon's child. He'd learned the truth only recently in a series of devastating revelations that had come close to destroying him. Even after all these months, even after the long-delayed reconciliation with Hendon, he still felt a stranger to himself. For if he wasn't Hendon's son, then who was he? Half of his history, half of himself, his unknown father's half, remained an enigma to him. A murky, mysterious world populated by the shadowy men and women from whom he was descended, and yet about whom he knew nothing. Nothing. Looking out over the jumbled ice of the frozen river, he told himself the free trader's tale of a French colonel with a Scottish name and yellow eyes meant nothing. Yes, yellow eyes were rare, but they were not unique. And while a Welsh cavalry officer, along with an English lord and a gypsy stable boy, had been amongst those named as Sophia Devlin's possible lover, no one had ever mentioned a Frenchman with a Scottish surname. He told himself that one of these days he was going to need to make peace with the mystery of his origins and accept that he would probably never learn what he was so desperate to know. He told himself these things. And still hope thrummed within him, undeniable and irrepressible. Chapter 30. After leaving the river, Sebastian went first to the Admiralty, where he made inquiries into the fate of a certain Rothschild galley. Then, pondering what he'd learned, he turned his steps east again, toward the Bank of England and the Exchange. Nathan Rothschild lived in the same modest brick residence from which he operated his businesses. Situated on a drab court off St. Swithin's Lane, just a stone's throw from the Bank of England, the Stock Exchange, and the official residence of the Mayor of London, the house was as squat and ugly as the warehouse that stood beside it. Dressed as he was for his meeting at the Cat and Fiddle, Sebastian half expected the middle-aged manservant in rusty livery who opened the door to turn him away. But before Sebastian had a chance to present his card, the man bowed and said, "Lord Devlin, yes, if you will kindly step into the book room, I will apprise Mr. Rothschild of your arrival." Sebastian was shown to a small frigid room lined with shelves stuffed with dusty ledgers and crowded with three tall desks. None of the desks had a stool, and there were no chairs in the room. He was standing at the narrow window overlooking the court and watching a couple of workmen transfer wooden crates from the back of a wagon to the warehouse next door when he heard Rothschild's heavy tread coming down the stairs. "What the devil do you want now?" the financier demanded as he drew up just inside the doorway. His drab old-fashioned frock coat was frayed at the hems, the overlong graying red hair fringed a balding pate. Sebastian turned to face him.
"Tell me about the Viking."
Rothschild's full lower lip jutted out, and he closed the door behind him with a snap.
"What about it?" "I'm told it was caught smuggling gold guineas." "That had nothing to do with me."
"Do you seriously expect me to believe that?" Rothschild snorted.
"I don't care what you believe."
From somewhere up above came the sound of a child's laughter. Then someone began playing the piano with exquisite skill. Sebastian glanced toward the sound.
"According to the Admiralty, the Viking was seized in the Channel on the night of January the 3rd. Given the excellence of your family's intelligence apparatus, I suspect it's more than likely that you received word of the Viking's fate the very next day, which coincidentally happens to have been the last Tuesday of the Great Fog,
and the date of Jane Ambrose's final visit to this house.
So, what happened?
Did she overhear something she wasn't supposed to hear? A conversation in which you betrayed your prior knowledge of the galley's illegal shipment, perhaps? Is that why she was frightened? Not because you terminated your arrangement with her, but because you threatened her. Perhaps even threatened to kill her if she told anyone what she had heard.
Not a single trace of emotion showed on Rothschild's face. Not surprise, alarm, fear, or anger. He remained utterly inscrutable.
Was Jane Ambrose here on the 4th? I do not recall.
You know she was.
Rothschild shrugged.
And if your supposition were true, which, of course, I in no way concede, do you seriously suppose that I would admit to it?
Sebastian gave the man a hard, tight smile. Actually, no. I'd expect you to react precisely as you have. Scornfully dismissive, arrogant, and utterly unconcerned with the death of a talented, innocent young woman you knew.
Rothschild made a rude noise.
I did not kill that woman.
What about the two men who attacked me the other day in Fleet Street? Did you send them? For the first time, Sebastian saw the faintest hint of a reaction in the man's pale, protruding eyes, quickly hidden by lowered lids.
I haven't the slightest idea what you're talking about.
Of course you don't. Sebastian picked up his hat from where it rested on the nearest desk. Rothschild opened the door for him.
As for the Viking, you don't understand the importance of what you have bumbled into. Take my advice and stay out of it.
Oh? Or you'll...
What?
Said Sebastian. Send someone to kill me. You already tried that, remember?
Something flickered again in the financier's pale eyes. Something angry and brutal. But Sebastian noticed that he didn't deny it.
You think Rothschild is the one who sent those men to kill you?
Gibson asked.
I wouldn't be surprised, said Sebastian, as the two men sat drinking mulled wine beside Gibson's kitchen fire.
Unfortunately, I doubt I'll ever be able to prove it.
And Jane Ambrose, did he kill her too?
I'd be inclined to think so, except...
Gibson glanced over at him.
Except?
Sebastian rocked back on his bench and crossed his arms.
I don't know.
Something feels wrong about it. Either that or I'm just missing something. Something important.
When's the fellow's inquest?
Tomorrow morning. Gibson pushed up to go throw more fuel on the fire.
You heard Alexei and Lady Devlin are going to that poor girl's hanging tomorrow. The one who came up to London after her husband was impressed.
Sebastian stared at him.
No.
Why? Her ladyship thinks they owe it to the girl to be there, and Alexei agreed.
Gibson paused.
It's going to be ugly.
Yes, said Sebastian, his heart heavy for his wife.
But then they know that.
Aye, Gibson admitted. So they do.
Later that evening, now dressed in elegant knee-breeches, a linen shirt, and a finely tailored greatcoat, Sebastian tucked an elegant walking stick under one arm and trolled the expensive pleasure haunts of the West End. He was looking for Viscount Ashworth, the handsome but deadly Marquis's heir who had married Sebastian's niece the previous September. Since securing the hand of Miss Stephanie Wilcox, Ashworth had reverted to his old habits, which meant spending his evenings in London's more notorious gaming establishments and brothels. Sebastian knew, because he'd been keeping an eye on the man ever since that fateful September day. Sebastian eventually spotted his quarry in a noisy hell near Leicester Square. But rather than directly approach his niece's husband, Sebastian simply hung back and watched. He watched Ashworth shift from EO table to faro to Rouge et Noir, drinking freely and laughing with friends, before casually tapping a black-haired whore against the wall in a darkened corner. Then he called for his greatcoat and hat, and whistling softly, set off alone toward the Haymarket. The night was so cold every sound seemed magnified. The crunch of Sebastian's boots in the snow, the clip-clop of horses' hooves, the tinkling notes of a piano underscored by men's voices and a woman's gay laughter. With each breath, the exhalation billowed around him to hang motionless in the cold, smoke-scented air. Oblivious to his shadow, Ashworth turned purposefully into Piccadilly. When the Marquis's son approached the dark, yawning mouth of an alley, Sebastian increased his pace. Coming up behind the man in a snow-muffled rush, he reached out to grab the Viscount's upper right arm at the same time he shoved hard against Ashworth's left shoulder. The force of the blow caused the man to pivot toward the entrance to the alley, just as Sebastian let him go. Ashworth staggered forward several steps off balance, then tripped on the walking stick Sebastian thrust between the man's legs. With a startled grunt, Ashworth went down hard on his stomach, his hands flung out at his sides in the snow. He was still collecting himself when Sebastian calmly planted his boot on the fallen man's right hand. "What the hell are you?" Ambrose began, then broke off to suck in a quick breath when Sebastian slid the stiletto from his walking stick and held the sharp tip against the bastard's cheek. "Shut up and listen," hissed Sebastian. Ashworth went utterly still, the whites of his eyes shining clearly in the moonlight as his gaze focused on the naked steel held against his face. "It's terrible how easy it is to have an accident," said Sebastian softly. "I'm told your wife had an accident recently as well. You do remember, don't you? The bruise on her cheek." Ashworth blinked. His breathing was perhaps more rapid than normal, but other than that he seemed remarkably calm. "I take it this display of calculated barbarism is intended to intimidate me."
"You could say that."
"I seem to recall you expressed the hope last September of seeing my lovely bride a widow by year's end. That didn't happen, did it?"
"Not yet."
Ashworth gave a low laugh. "Are you planning to take up murder now? And here I was under the impression you hold the practice in exaggerated repugnance. That is why you indulge in that peculiar pastime of yours, is it not?"
"There are ways to destroy a man besides killing him."
"True. But unless you are willing to ruin your own dear niece in the process, the number of options narrows considerably."
"Narrows, but does not disappear," said Sebastian, leaning into the stiletto ever so slightly.
Ashworth blinked again, but remained silent. Sebastian said,
"Just remember, I'm watching you. Give me the faintest glimmer of an excuse, and I will take it. Without hesitation."
"You can try." Sebastian gave a slow smile.
"I seem to recall your late friend Sir Francis Rowe expressing a similar sentiment right before he died.
Rowe was a fool."
"And you think you're not?"
Sebastian subtly increased the weight on Ashworth's hand as he drew a thin, bloody line across the man's cheek with the tip of his blade.
"Hurt my niece again, and you'll regret it."
Sebastian stepped back and sheathed his sword.
"You've been warned."
Chapter 31. Tuesday, 1st of February. The next morning, Hero rose before the sun and dressed in a somber carriage gown, warm socks, and heavy brocons. She was settling a veiled, low-crowned hat on her hair when Devlin came up behind her to put his hands on her waist.
"Ever been to a hanging before?" he asked softly.
She turned to face him.
"No." "The crowds can get rough."
"Alexei warned me. Tom offered to come with us, but I didn't think that would be fair." Tom's brother, Huey, had just been 13 when he was hanged as a thief. Devlin said,
"If I didn't have this damned inquest."
She brushed his lips with hers.
"I know."
His gaze met hers, and she saw the worry he was trying to hide. He said,
"Why do this? Why force yourself to watch that poor young woman hang?"
"Because she has no family in London, and someone should be there for her." She reached for her gloves and drew them on with swift, jerking motions. What kind of society steals a man away from his pregnant young wife to send him off to war, and then hangs her when she steals to try to keep herself and her child alive?
One with its values in serious need of realignment.
Would it ever change, do you think?
Perhaps.
She gave a faint smile. You don't sound convinced.
Armies will always need cannon fodder, and shopkeepers and merchants will always have more clout than starving women and children.
I keep trying to imagine what she must be going through, but it seems unbearable.
I suspect it is.
The day dawned clear but bitterly cold, despite the golden sunlight that spilled across the awakening city. Hero thought the frigid temperatures might reduce the number of spectators at the hanging, but she was wrong. She and Alexei arrived at the Old Bailey, the street before Newgate Prison, where hangings were held, to find a surging, raucous, malodorous crowd of thousands. Men, women, and children, their shouts and laughter joining into a roar. The atmosphere was that of a fair, with pie sellers and broadside hawkers and a flotilla of dirty, ragged urchins who darted through the milling throng to pick the pockets of the unwary.
"It's probably because they're hanging a woman," said Alexei,
her face tight with suppressed emotion as they pushed their way through the crush of onlookers toward the ramshackle old house from which they had arranged to watch the hanging.
"The crowds are always larger for women, especially when they're young. Women and highwaymen and notorious murderers."
The house they'd selected lay almost directly opposite the scaffold, and, like most of the other buildings overlooking the street, rented out its windows for hangings. As they reached the door, the slow, mournful tolling of a bell began somewhere deep inside Newgate. The bell would continue tolling until the last of the day's condemned prisoners was cut down, dead. Hero thought it must be hideous, living within the sound of that bell.
"Hear that?" said the portly house owner, pocketing their money.
He jerked his balding head toward a steep, narrow staircase behind him.
"That means the condemned's already been brought into the yard to have their irons struck off. Best hurry."
"How many hangings have you attended?" Hero asked Alexei as they climbed the worn ancient steps.
"Just one. A friend of mine was hanged not long after I arrived in London. I promised I'd be there for him. And I was."
Hero suspected there was more to the story than that, but she had no intention of asking for details. There was much about this French woman that remained a mystery to them all. The wide casement window of their chosen chamber looked down on the scaffold across the street. Essentially, a large wooden platform draped with black cloth, it reminded Hero of a stage, which she supposed in a sense it was. The scaffold was always erected just outside the prison's lodge, directly in front of what was known as the debtor's door, so that the condemned would not be seen by the crowd until they mounted the steps to the platform itself. A small roofed shelter with chairs stood at the rear of the scaffold for important officials, and soldiers with pikes were stationed around the perimeter, guarding it. It struck Hero, watching the nervous way the men clutched their pikes, that beneath the crowd's typical air of excitement and anticipation lay something else, something hostile and angry.
"Who else is being hanged today? Do you know?"
"Three men, poachers, I think," said Alexei.
It did much to explain the mood of the crowd. Murderers and their like were usually greeted with jeers and catcalls and often pelted with rotten food or even stones. But most of the people in the street were desperately poor themselves. Their sympathies would lie with those about to die. The bell of the nearby Church of St. Sepulchre joined the Newgate bell and began to toll, sounding the death knell. Alexei thrust open the old-fashioned windows and cold air rushed in, bringing them the roar of the crowd and a chorus of more distant shouts that rose up from within Newgate. The prisoners in the cells fronting the yard were calling farewells and encouragement to the condemned on their way to the lodge. Alexis said, "They're coming." There was a notable stirring in the crowd below. The sheriff and under-sheriff of the City of London emerged from the covered stairway first, their eyes narrowing as they came into the lengthening daylight. Clothed in long, fur-trimmed robes with the heavy chains of their office around their shoulders, both held ceremonial silver-tipped staves and solemnly took their seats along with a scattering of other officials. The ordinary, or prison chaplain, came next, his head bowed over his prayer book. A hush of anticipation fell over the crowd, so that Hero could hear his deep, mournful voice intoning the burial service.
O God, whose days are without end, and whose mercies cannot be numbered, make us, we pray, deeply aware of the shortness and uncertainty of human life.
Hero curled her hands over the windowsill in front of her, and leaned forward, sucking the cold, foul air deep into her lungs. She knew a strange sense of unreality, as if part of her somehow refused to accept that this was happening, that she was watching the bizarre spectacle of her government setting about deliberately murdering four desperately impoverished human beings with a degree of pomp and solemnity that suddenly struck her as obscene. A turnkey appeared at the top of the stairs, and Hero said, "She's first." Amy Hatcher reached the last step, stumbling and blinking at the brightness as she emerged into the light. She had the heavy hemp noose that would be used to kill her draped around her shoulders, and in her arms she clutched a small bundle that Hero realized was her baby. "Oh, Lord," Hero whispered, watching the poor girl stagger on the rough planking. Terror distorted her red, tear-streaked face, and her chest jerked visibly with each rapid, shallow gasp of air. At the sight of the heavy beam above her, she tried to shrink back, her head shaking from side to side as she pleaded, "Oh, please, no. Please, no." "Why is she still holding her child?" said Hero.
"It's probably the only way they could get her out here without dragging her."
The three condemned men who came behind Amy had their hands tied together in front and their elbows pinioned tight against their torsos. All moved awkwardly, without their leg irons, as if they had become so accustomed to their weight they now found it difficult to walk without them. A roar went up from the spectators.
"Hats off, hats off, so we can see."
The men in the crowd whipped off their tall hats. Hero found herself watching the watchers. Not only was the street below crammed with a surging, shoving crowd, but every window overlooking the space was occupied by gawkers affluent enough to pay for a better view of the spectacle. On the roof of a nearby house, she could see a man with a telescope trained on the condemned. A well-dressed young woman with a pair of opera glasses leaned out of a window of the inn next door. Judging by the faint smile curling the woman's lips, she was not here to support any of those doomed to die. Then a turnkey snatched the child from Amy Hatcher's arms, and the condemned girl began to scream and struggle against the hands that reached out to hold her.
"My baby. Oh, God, no. Please don't take her. Give me just one more minute with her. Oh, please don't do this."
The sheriff tightened his hold on his staff, his lips pressing into a thin line of distaste, as if there was something unseemly, something un-English about a young mother objecting to her own murder, and what would surely be the inevitable death of her orphaned babe. The condemned were expected to cooperate, to make a good end, and die repenting their sins and commending their spirits to God. Amy Hatcher was not supposed to create a scene, screaming and crying and half-fainting, so that the two turnkeys had to hold her up, one at each side, while her wrists were bound with cords and her elbows pinned to her body. The rope was taken from her thin shoulders and affixed to one of the black butcher's hooks in the heavy beam above, while the noose was slipped over her head.
"Lord Jesus Christ," prayed the ordinary, his voice booming
as if he could somehow drown out her hysterical pleadings.
By your death you took away the sting of death. Grant to us, your servants, so to follow in faith where you have led the way.
The baby was wailing now, too, a thin, reedy cry intertwined with the mother's frantic pleadings.
Oh, please!
A hush had fallen over the watching crowd, their upturned faces rapt as the three condemned men were led onto the trapdoor beside Amy, and carefully positioned on the marks chalked there. One of the men was older, perhaps in his late 30s, but the other two were heartbreakingly young, still boys, a man and his two sons. All three were doing their best to die game, their heads held high and grim half-smiles plastered in place. But Hero could see their legs shaking, see the sweat that glistened on their pinched, pale faces despite the cold. The sheriff said something, and one of the turnkeys stepped forward to bind the woman's skirts around her legs with a strap to keep them from billowing up immodestly as her body fell. Because heaven forbid, thought Hero, that the multitude gathered to watch her die a hideous, painful death should be given a glimpse of her ankles.
Receive them into the arms of your mercy, into the blessed rest of everlasting peace, and into the glorious company of the saints in light, prayed the ordinary, closing his prayer book. Amen.
All four condemned prisoners were now in place, the nooses around their necks, and the executioner stepped forward to yank the white hoods down over their faces. Then, at the sheriff's signal, the hangman pulled the lever that slid back the timbers supporting the long trapdoor. One of the doomed boys shouted,
"Lord, have mercy on me,"
as the trap fell with a loud crash that echoed around the street. Four bodies dropped with an ugly jerk, but the distance they were allowed to fall was short, just 18 inches. And so, rather than breaking their necks, the ropes simply began to strangle them. Slowly.
"Oh, no,"
whispered Hero, as the dying prisoners writhed in agony, twisting and twitching helplessly, the men's legs kicking out spasmodically. Do the Morris dance on air, they called it. Dance the hempen measure, and cut a caper on the way to hell. All were euphemisms for hanging, cynical descriptions of the macabre jerks and gyrations performed by the condemned in their death throes. There had been a time when executions used to take place out at Tyburn, where the doomed prison's friends and loved ones could grasp the dying men's and women's legs and pull, thus speeding their deaths. But that was no longer allowed. Now those who could afford it paid the hangman to do basically the same thing. But such a luxury was beyond the means of a desperate woman condemned for stealing food or three poor poachers. And so the executioner simply stood with his arms crossed at his chest and watched them suffer.
"I should have left her money for the hangman," Hero said, stricken. "I didn't think."
Alexei sucked in a shaky breath.
"Neither did I."
An eternity later, Hero said, "My God, how much longer can it go on?"
"Sometimes it can take as long as 4 or 5 minutes. It's a horrible way to die, strangling. That's why the French instituted the guillotine."
The young poacher's bowels and bladders had released, staining their breeches. And still the dying fought to live, uselessly, hopelessly. Finally, one after the other, they ceased to struggle until all four dangling bodies simply swayed heavily at the ends of their ropes. They would be left hanging like this for an hour before being cut down. St. Sepulchre's bell gave one final clang and fell silent. The prison bell tolled on and on. The gathering of dignitaries beneath the pavilion rose to their feet and filed off the platform in a solemn procession. They would now retire to the keeper's house, where they would consume the traditional post-hanging breakfast of deviled kidneys. With the departure of the officials, the crowd of spectators pressed forward. Many would pay the hangman a shilling to touch the hands of the dead, which was believed to be a cure for warts and tumours and other growths. An executioner could make quite a tidy sum out of a hanging, since he would also be allowed to sell the clothes of the dead and to cut the ropes used to kill them into short lengths to sell as souvenirs. Hero glanced over at Alexei and was shocked to see the Frenchwoman's face wet with tears.
"It's barbarism,"
said Alexei, her accent unusually heavy.
"How can anyone think this is right?
To kill a starving 17-year-old girl for stealing a ham?
A ham!"
Reaching out, Hero grasped her friend's hand tight. And for a long moment, the two women simply held on to each other as the crowds dissipated below and the cold golden sun slid behind a new bank of clouds. Chapter 32.
"His name was Jack Donovan,"
Sir Henry Lovejoy told Sebastian, as the two men stood side by side, staring down at the ashen, naked corpse of the man killed in the Strand. The body lay face down on an old door, propped up on two empty whiskey barrels, in the tap room of the Black Swan on Fleet Street. For the viewing of the body of the deceased was an important part of any inquest. The jurors who'd been called to serve were still milling about, along with a number of curious onlookers. By law, any sudden, violent or unexplained death required an inquest, and because there were so few places capable of holding the kinds of crowds gruesome dead bodies could attract, the proceedings typically were held in a public house or an inn.
"So who was he?"
asked Sebastian, his eyes narrowing as he studied the purple knife wound in the dead man's back.
"A generally unsavory character from the sounds of it, although by all accounts not a simple thief."
"I suspect he wasn't after your purse."
"I didn't think he was."
Sir Henry nodded.
"Unfortunately, we've no idea who he was working for or who his companion and inadvertent murderer might have been." "Lovely."
Sir Henry shivered. A fire had recently been kindled on the enormous old-fashioned hearth, but the blaze was meagre, and the room was still cold enough that few of those present were inclined to remove their greatcoats.
"You've no idea who might have an interest in seeing you dead."
"Not really."
A commotion near the door foretold the imminent arrival of the coroner. Sir Henry glanced behind them, then lowered his voice to say,
"One of my lads did learn something you might find of interest. Edward Ambrose is in debt."
"Did your lad manage to discover why?"
"The usual, mainly gambling, along with an unhealthy addiction to Bond Street tailors and high-end jewellers such as Rundle and Breach."
"Any sign of a mistress?"
"My lads say there is talk, but they've yet to verify it."
The magistrate pursed his lips in thought.
"The debt obviously reflects poorly on Mr. Ambrose's character, but unless he's planning to acquire a new rich wife, I fail to see how it constitutes a motive for murder."
"It doesn't.
If Jane was murdered.
But if Ambrose struck her in anger and accidentally killed her, the debt might explain the nature of their quarrel."
"There is that."
Sir Henry shivered again and drew a handkerchief from his pocket to blow his nose.
"You've seen the frozen river?"
"Yesterday afternoon. Amazing, is it not?"
Sir Henry nodded, although he looked more troubled than impressed.
"There's talk of setting up a frost fair. Personally, I fail to see the attraction of freezing in a tent pitched on ice simply to experience the dubious pleasure of drinking expensive beer, or purchasing a useless trinket at twice its worth, so that one may afterwards boast that it was acquired on the Thames."
Sebastian laughed just as a constable came bustling into the tap room, clapped his hands loudly and said,
"Right then, let's get this started, shall we?"
As expected, the inquest returned a verdict of homicide by person or persons unknown. Afterwards, Sebastian joined Lovejoy for a ploughman's lunch in the inn's public room. The pub was crowded with a motley assortment of hangers-on from the inquest, shopkeepers and tradesmen,
costermongers and apprentices, all loud and boisterous with lingering excitement from the morning's entertainment.
"I'll never understand it," said Lovejoy, nibbling without much appetite at a heel of bread. "Why would anyone want to deliberately look at the bloody corpse of a murdered man?"
"Presumably for the same reason they attend hangings," said Sebastian, his thoughts on the ordeal he knew Hero was going through.
"I've never understood that either. We hang felons in public as a warning to all potential lawbreakers. The spectacle is intended to put the fear of God into them. But in reality, all we do is to provide the city's pickpockets with a distracted crowd enjoying a free show."
Sebastian found himself smiling.
"You're suggesting public hangings might not work as a deterrent?" "One would deduce. As for hanging a man, let alone a woman or a child, for stealing a handkerchief or a pheasant, I fear future generations will conclude we place little value on the lives of England's poor."
Sebastian drained his ale and set it aside.
"Future generations will be right."
Sebastian spent the next hour trying to find Edward Ambrose. The playwright's nervous servants claimed ignorance of his whereabouts. In the end, Sebastian tracked Jane's widower to a low tavern on Compton Street. From the looks of it, the place dated back to the last years of the 17th century, with low, dark beams overhead and sawdust on the floor, and a wide hearth beside which Ambrose sat slumped. He had one hand wrapped around a bottle of cheap scotch, and he looked up lazily when Sebastian slid into the opposite bench.
"Ah, it wanted only that," said Ambrose, raising the bottle to his lips without bothering to use the glass that stood near his elbow. "Bit early, isn't it?" "Is it? So, are you drowning your sorrows or assuaging your guilt?" asked Sebastian. "You say that as if the two were mutually exclusive."
When Sebastian remained silent, Ambrose took another drink, then wiped his wet lips with the back of one hand.
"I was a rotten husband to her. She was brilliant and beautiful and giving, and I took it all without appreciating any of it."
"And you hit her."
Something flared in Ambrose's eyes, something that was hidden when he dropped his gaze to the bottle again.
"Exactly. How deeply in debt are you?" said Sebastian,
then added when Ambrose's head jerked up,
"And don't even think about trying to deny it."
Ambrose slumped back in his seat.
"How the devil did you discover that? Did you think I would not?"
Ambrose shook his head and swallowed hard. Sebastian said, "How deep?" Ambrose's face twitched.
"Nearly £5,000.
A large but not insurmountable sum for a man in my position.
Theoretically."
"Theoretically?"
"I did not kill my wife," said Ambrose,
his lips pulling away from his teeth as he enunciated each word carefully.
"That is why you're here, isn't it? You think my debts somehow implicate me in her death? Well, believe me, you couldn't be more wrong."
"Why the bloody hell should I believe you?"
"Why?"
Ambrose gave a ragged laugh.
"Because only a fool would kill the goose that lays the golden eggs."
He leaned forward, his voice dropping.
"You don't understand, do you? Oh, I had a couple of plays produced before Jane and I married, but their reception was only lukewarm. It wasn't until I turned my hand to opera that I had real success. Lancelot and Guinevere opened a week after our first wedding anniversary."
"You're saying what? That Jane was your muse?" Ambrose gave a ringing laugh.
"My muse? God, that's rich. For all intents and purposes, Jane was Edward Ambrose. Oh, I wrote some of the libretto. But the music, that glorious music, was all Jane's. Not mine. Jane's."
Sebastian watched the playwright bring the bottle to his lips and drink deeply, a rivulet of alcohol running to escape down the side of his chin.
Did no one ever suspect?
Ambrose set the bottle down with studied care.
Her twin, James, knew the truth. She couldn't hide it from him. He knew the instant he heard that first opera that the music was hers. She never told Christian, but I think he pretty much figured it out, too.
He brought up trembling hands to rake the disheveled hair from his face with splayed fingers.
So you see, I'm the last person who'd ever want Jane dead. Unless she threatened to leave you.
Ambrose froze, with his elbows still spread wide, his gaze on Sebastian's face. Sebastian said,
I can see a certain kind of man who owed his success, his very livelihood, to a woman becoming enraged if she threatened to leave him. Jane would never have left me. She would never leave you when walking out on her marriage meant losing her sons. But now, if she found out you were drowning in debt and spending the money she'd actually earned on a mistress, I can imagine her at least threatening to leave you, and I can see you flying into a rage and hitting her, the way you'd hit her so many times in the past. Only this time she struck her head on something when she fell, and she didn't get up again. And when you saw what you'd done, you wrapped her body in, what, a carpet, a blanket, an old greatcoat, and carried her out into the snowy night to leave her in Shepherd's Lane.
Ambrose stared at him, jaw slack, nostrils flaring with alarm.
No! The only thing I don't understand is, why Shepherd's Lane? Did you mistakenly think her lessons with Mary Godwin were on Thursday rather than Fridays? I didn't kill her, damn you.
I don't believe you.
Ambrose might be drunk, but he wasn't too drunk to know that men had swung on flimsy conjectures such as this. His tongue flicked out to wet his lips.
You were asking me the other day about the Rothschild girl Jane was teaching.
Yes, Sebastian frowned.
Why?
Ambrose leaned forward.
Jane had an aunt who was married to Sheridan, Richard Sheridan. Sheridan and I never exactly got along, but he came to see me last night. Spun some crazy tale about Rothschild and gold shipments to France and wanted to know if Jane had ever talked to me about it.
Had she?
No. I'd never heard any of it before. But Sheridan was damnably upset about it all, I can tell you that. Went away muttering under his breath. I couldn't catch most of it, but he was saying something like, I blame myself.
I blame myself?
Ambrose nodded.
I did tell you I thought her strangely frightened by her last meeting with Rothschild.
Didn't I tell you?
You did. So you'll look into it?
I will.
Sebastian pushed up from the table.
Why would Jane tell her late aunt's husband what was frightening her, but not her own husband?
Ambrose's head fell back as he stared up at Sebastian.
What do I know of the government's gold policy? Sheridan spent decades in Parliament.
That he did, said Sebastian, reaching for his hat. But Edward Ambrose only tipped his head and frowned, as if the larger implications of his statement eluded him. Richard Sheridan was feeding scraps to a colony of stray cats in the noisome alley behind his house when Sebastian came to stand with one shoulder propped against a nearby corner.
How did you find me? Asked the old man without looking up.
He was wearing a tattered greatcoat, scuffed boots, and the same nightcap Sebastian had seen on him before. Grey stubble shadowed his unshaven face.
Your housemaid?
Ah,
Lizzie. She's a treasure.
Poor girl hasn't been paid in months, but she won't give up on us.
Don't know what we'd do without her.
Sebastian said,
Why didn't you tell me your niece tangled with Rothschild over a shipment of smuggled gold?
Been talking to Ambrose, have you?
Yes.
Sherilyn reached down to pet a grey tabby rubbing against his legs.
It all happened so many weeks ago. I frankly wasn't even thinking about it when you were here before. I was focused on the last time I'd seen her. It wasn't until after you...